A decade of dissonant discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back. Oh, sorry, I haven't got my camera on. Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. I'm now here with the Ferryman's Toll, a Canadian content creator. Would you like to introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah, for sure. my name's Alex Rand. I go by the Ferryman's Toll or the Ferryman. I've been a content creator for about 4 years now, as well as an activist and somebody who engages in the creation of active clubs and nationalist organizations in Canada. Started out creating memes, and those picked up. A lot of them went really viral, started developing a following, slowly got into streaming and video content creation. And then now that's predominantly what I do. I stream and make video content. But yeah, that's more or less my story.
Were you involved with the OG alt-right, like 2015, 16, or did you get into this later than that?
So I was a passive observer of what was going on pretty much since I've been an adult. So I've always been interested in politics. I was a political science major in university, so it's something that I've always had an interest in, but it was never something that I really dived into myself. I didn't really consider myself, you know, somebody who would become active in it. It was more of something I was interested in, but also detested. So I didn't really see myself, you know, being involved in that way. The thing that drove me to actually becoming politically engaged and creating my own content was the COVID nonsense. That kind of pushed me over the edge and put me in a place where now you kind of have to do something. So at that point, that was where I began, you know, as I say, making my own content, networking, building an audience and a following, stuff like that. And it has ramped up basically in the wake of the trucker convoy in Canada, which I was heavily involved in. I was there the entire time, and that was where a lot of people discovered my stuff and what I created. So I'm also part of, like, that we call it the Plaid Army. It's a collective of streamers in Canada. So there's Jeremy McKenzie, who I think you're talking to tomorrow, Derek Rance, you know, Edgy, like there's a whole retinue of us there that kind of all you know, revolve around the same sphere with similar politics and similar perspectives on things. So we kind of bolster each other and help each other out. So that was, yeah.
Good idea to have that. All right. So let's, I could pick up on various things, but you said that you studied political science at university. What was that like? Cause I've heard of this degree. It's available in various universities in Britain as well. It's a well-known thing. You hear about people studying it in America before they go into a career in politics. Was that your intention? And what was the degree itself like? And did you regret taking it? Was it good? Et cetera.
So I took it because I was interested in it. I was also a history minor. And so if you're obviously these things go hand in hand. If you study history, you tend to study politics. If you study politics, by definition, you're going to have to study a lot of history to understand the political context of things. So history is the thing that I really love and I'm interested in. And politics was kind of the side thing. However, a history major has even less practical application now than a political science major does. And a political science major doesn't really have much, you know, practical application either. And I regretted taking it until probably just a few years ago. So I was in school from 2007 to 2011 and obviously I didn't really do anything with that degree. It was just kind of something that I had, you know, as many people have with their arts degrees at this point. In hindsight now, it's been very useful because a lot of the knowledge that I accrued in that time period is very relevant to the things that I talk about now and the things that we discuss on streams. And just having that general background knowledge is very good if you're going to talk about the current political situation. However, there's nothing, I'll say this, there's nothing I learned in a political science major that I couldn't have learned from the internet. And there are many people who did not take a political science degree that are much more knowledgeable and well-read than I am. So it's, you know, as with most things in universities now, it's not really useful. That being said, what was it like? I was on the early stages of when things started to get really insane on university campuses.
I'll just say now, it sounds like you were at university about 6 or 7 years after I started. Well, it was when you started. And when I was there, there really wasn't any of the insanity. So it's interesting to hear this. So yeah, please go into it.
Yeah, I mean, it was not like it is now, or at least as I understand that it is now. However, it was definitely going in that direction. Obviously, the university campuses, at least in Canada, and I'm sure it's very similar in the UK or America, have been very liberal for some time. But there was still this mask of acceptance of right-wing political perspectives or conservative political ideals that you could get away with talking about them. Now, I don't think that I could talk about a lot of the things that I would want to. And even at the time, I did get in trouble a few times for pushing back on left-wing talking points within seminars and classrooms. So, it was starting then. And you could see how it was going in a very negative direction, which is one of the things that pushed me towards libertarian political ideology, which I think is something that many of us went through in this sphere, in this right-wing dissident sphere, because you seek for a way to deal with a problem that doesn't result in a lot of conflict. And libertarian seems like a very practical way of dealing with that, which is just, you know, we'll just all look at each other as individuals and we'll all forget about our, you know, immutable characteristics and things like this. And we'll just pretend that those things don't matter. And that way we don't have to, you know, fight about this and we can just drop the identity politics and not use it as a weapon.
Yeah. And it's also that idea that you're exerting power on me, but here's an idea for how we could live without you exerting power on me or vice versa. So we could just be equal. It's a strange, the libertarian thing, and I don't want to go on a rant about that, but it does seem like a last ditch attempt to have a sane life without lots of conflict.
It's precisely what I view it as the last, as you said, the last ditch attempt from conservatives to avoid the conflict. It's their way of basically giving up everything that they truly believe in without engaging in a fight and losing everything at the same time. So it's their way of saying, like, look, we'll concede on every social point, we'll concede on all of these things as long as you give us our property and let us continue being individuals and have our individual rights, then we'll give you everything you want, essentially. And they're not going to accept that. So again, this is why, I mean, I've gone off on rants as well before, because it took me a long time to figure this out, that this is obviously a losing strategy. It's never going to work. It's just a weakness. It's just something that allows them to, railroad you into the ground. So, I'm not a fan anymore, obviously, but that was just part of my journey.
Yeah. So then COVID, you said that had a formative effect, or it's what spurred you to get involved in all of this. It seems that, you know, COVID was bad enough in Britain, but it seems like we got off lightly compared to Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. So can you describe your experience of COVID in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, I've tried, I feel like I've tried to repress a lot of it, but it was just insane. It was insanity. Nothing made sense. Everything they told us was a lie, obviously. And it got to a point where there was no choice left. It was you had to get involved and you had to try to do something because there was no end in sight. And it just kept getting obviously more insane by the day. There was talks about jailing the unvaccinated. There was talks about, re-education. There was talks about, people getting fired, people getting, the same things that, we're all familiar with that we were put through. And so it just, to me, it was a moment that a lot of people think about these moments and they think that in these moments, they'll do what's right. This is the kind of classic boomer mentality of like, oh, if they tried to come for me, I'd give them a piece of, my mind. I wouldn't let them Nazis.
If I'd been in Nazi Germany, I would have sheltered some Jews.
Yes. And what we found out is that's actually not true. That's not true at all. In fact, most people turned into the Stasi or the NKVD. That's what they turned into. That's what it was like living in Canada. That's you had, family members turn on family members. Like I went through some of that. You had friends of forever turn on friends, and all because of government propaganda and conditioning. So it was a wake up call on how easy it is for them to manipulate the masses. Luckily we broke out of it as a lot of people did, but, or as pretty much everywhere did, but yeah, I'll never forget how easy it was for them to manipulate, Canadians, because it was pretty easy.
I mean, it seemed like Canada was, like a prison. Yeah. Kind of like a locked, you couldn't, cause I knew people who were wanting to visit relatives and friends, for serious reasons, for funerals and stuff, and they couldn't leave Canada unless they got vaccinated.
And it was worse than that. You couldn't go to your own family members' funerals in Canada if you were Canadian. Like that's how bad. Let alone leave the country.
And they had that thing where when you landed as a Canadian citizen, if you landed.
Yeah.
What was it? You had to be in a hotel for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks or something. So. And you had to pay for that. Yes. And you had to get tested every day or something. It was absolutely insane.
Yeah.
I mean, again, this is the stuff that people forget so quickly because you want
to. I forget about it. Like I said, I almost try to repress it. Like I just try to. to me, the fight has moved on to a new theater, a new front. So. I try not to dwell on this because you get a lot of that. You get a lot of people dwelling on what they did, 3 years ago. And believe me, I want them held accountable for it as well. But, the fight has moved on and you're still, poking over the, the corpses that are left behind. It's just, so I try not to get bogged down in it too much because a lot of people just spin their wheels in the past. But
I'm asking you because it's your first time on Millennial, but also because I don't often get an opportunity to ask this in retrospect. Like, how do you see COVID now? It's not that I want to dwell on it because obviously, of course, it is 3-4 years ago now. It's just, it's of curiosity to me.
Yeah, I mean... I think, if I was going to summarize, I'd say it was the most insane time that's ever happened in Canadian history, and very few people recognize it as such.
Yeah. So. When we move forward to the trucker convoy, and I'm asking this because you said you were involved with that, what was your perception of that? Because there were various people, various accounts of it. It was very attacked in the media, certainly over here. And yet it seemed like it was really genuinely good, decent, well-intentioned people. Yeah. But again, they got punished by the state. And so what was your experience of that?
So I was there the entire time. I was there before the convoy arrived, and I was there after it left. And so I was downtown in Ottawa every day during the convoy. So, I saw the whole thing proceed, and, you know, it culminated in my own arrest. So, like, I had the full experience, I guess you could say, of the convoy. It's much like you described. For the most part, it was just people who were tired. It kind of turned into a party. For those who are familiar with, you know, Ottawa in that time of year, there's a winter festival called Winterlude, which is, you know, it focuses on the Rideau Canal, which is, you know, the world's longest skating rink and outdoor skating rink, right? And you have ice sculptures and all these things. Sorry, my dog's decided to take a drink right now. I don't know if you can hear that.
No, don't worry. It's okay.
But it kind of turned into that. It because that was all canceled because of COVID, right? So you kind of had this kind of street festival, you know, party going on downtown. And it was like everybody was just blowing off steam. Like they had been cooped up for 2 years, and it was, you know, they were finally given an opportunity to just, you know, have fun again and just be normal. And that's basically what it was for the most part. Obviously, they turned it into this, uprising, occupation. They're trying to overthrow the government. They're trying to do this. And I don't know, maybe it was those things. But if it was those things, it was the most peaceful and well-intentioned version of those things that have ever occurred. So, I mean, it obviously... You know, there was no pitchforks and torches and firearms and bombs. There was hockey sticks and bouncy castles and, you know, hot chocolate. Like it was a pretty chill uprising, if that's what it was.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's important to remember that it was throughout all of, throughout most of 2020 and then 2021 lockdown. So of various kinds at different phases. So by the time that came along, which I think was January, early January 2022, it had been basically 2 years of this madness and what felt like oppression. I think it was oppression.
It wasn't just that it had been 2 years. It was that they were not, it wasn't getting... things weren't dissipating. They were getting worse. So at the time that the truck, like, you know, it was 2 years and it was, they were talking about stricter vaccine mandates. They were talking about limiting trucker, like that. That's what was the catalyst, right? Limiting truckers who were unvaccinated from crossing the U.S. border, which if you're familiar with Canadian U.S. relations, that's a huge, that's like 70% of our trade is trucking across the border, right? So if you're a trucker in Canada, like the chances are that's a huge part of your livelihood, and not being able to do that is going to result in you, you know, no longer having one. So that was kind of the catalyst that set it off. But it was, you know, this just before this in late December, early January of 2021, 2022, they were talking about that. That's where you had those stories of, you know, should the unvaccinated be jailed? Should they be put in camps? Should they be subject to re-education? Should they be mandatory? You know, should they be subjected to mandatory vaccination? This type of stuff. So like that, it was hot then. That's what people don't understand is how tense it actually was. And like there, people were on a knife edge. And the fact that it turned into what the Freedom Convoy was and not something much more, I don't know. Grim,
forthright. Let's see.
Yeah, it is like a testament to the patience of the Canadian people. I would argue through a fault, honestly, that we have too much patience and too much tolerance. But the way that played out was beautiful until it wasn't, obviously.
And yeah, and the state clamped down on it, arresting people, imprisoning people. There was one other thing that happened around that time connected to all of this, which was there was I can't remember the politician's name, but he was in the Canadian Parliament and he'd come upon some document that said, it was talking about detention facilities, concentration camps kind of thing. And it said that there should be a wide latitude for the types of people who can be put into into these detention facilities. And I mean, it really sounded like the stuff of dystopian,
yeah,
totalitarian nightmare kind of thing.
I think, and, I think the politician talking about it was probably Randy Hillier.
Yes, that was it. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And he discovered
and it just got yeah, brushed aside. They just, the speaker, the leader of the parliament just, it was like, no, this isn't going to be discussed.
Yeah.
And it was really amazing. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's a good point, which is like, these are the kinds of things that were being discussed. And, you know, these mass COVID facility processing sites and turning hotels into camps and building like new, I don't know what you would call them, prison camps kind of things. Like, these were all things that were on the table legitimately, you know, being planned. And it was only in the wake of the convoy that all of these things got canceled. So, like, it again, people, if you're not familiar, like, there was a domino effect that happened. It started during the convoy and continued until about a month after. But essentially, about a month after the Freedom Convoy, there was no more mandates. They were gone, with the exception of a few, the flying and the border. But even those were gone within, I think, another 4 months. So we went from them talking about imprisoning us or, you know, refusing us access to basically everything in person to all of the mandates being dropped within a few months. And it was, you know, they won't admit it, but it was directly a result of the convoy and the way people reacted to their reaction to the convoy, which was obviously we're just going to smash. And, you know, it was basically brute force and ignorance was their response to people saying they've had enough. So,
and it's interesting because it's interesting to hear you say that you think the convoy was very successful and sort of victorious, because I'm glad, and I hope that's true, because the response of Trudeau's government, and here we'll get on to broader issues of Trudeau, the response of his government was kind of similar to Starmer's response to the recent riots in England, where it was this neoliberal elite, you might say cultural Marxist, becoming authoritarian, like hard. You've had the velvet glove, here's the iron fist now kind of thing. And it's a weird switch when it happened. All of COVID kind of represents this, I think, because all over, like Germany, Sweden, not Sweden, but all these other countries, what had been touchy-feely, hippy-dippy, rainbow stuff in the 2010s suddenly got hardcore and aggressive and negative. It was an interesting switch and horrible. But with Trudeau, it seemed like he was prepared. I mean, there was the stuff with, and again, I don't want to make this too much retrospective, but I remember that thing where a recording came out of Canadian police sort of laughing about driving horses over people, something like that.
That was leaked by Jeremy.
Oh, right. I didn't know that.
So you can speak to him about that tomorrow, right, if you want to get into that. But yeah, this is one of the reasons why they really don't like us is we've been able to hit them where it hurts a few times. And that was one by Jeremy that they really didn't like. So he was able to, you know, through a source leak RCMP group chats, and they weren't exactly great optics for the RCMP. Nothing came of that. They were not punished in any way whatsoever for their conduct, but I mean, it was eye-opening to the people. And this is one thing that was incredibly frustrating for Jeremy and myself and a few others during the convoy, which was we understood what was going to happen. We knew that what they were going to do. We saw, and you could, if you were paying attention to what was going on outside of the Ottawa scene, you would have known that it was coming, because the convoy was not just one, you know, protest in Ottawa. It was a lot of protests across the entire country, including, you know, I think there was four or five different border blockades that were going on at the same time with the U.S. border. There was Ambassador Bridge. There was one in, I can't remember what it's called, in B.C. There was one at Coutts, Alberta. There was one in Emerson, Manitoba, and another one in Saskatchewan. and they systematically broke these up, and it was, you could see what they were doing. They targeted the ones that were the most essential. They devoted the police resources where they needed to get trade moving again. And you could see, like, they had to move these police forces around from place to place. It was the same cops. So if, like, in Canada is not a very populous country. I think there's like 100,000 police officers in the entire country of all levels, right? It's from RCMP to provincial to municipal levels. There's only like 100,000. That's not a lot, especially when you have multiple protests across the country of 50,000 people. They had to scrape every police officer they could just to, you know, manage the protest in Ottawa. They were bringing people in from Quebec. They were bringing them in from Calgary and Vancouver. Like, they had to find every available police officer that they could to do what they did. And so the reason I bring this up is because we were able to predict what was going to happen. We knew they were going to bring the police. We knew they were going to do exactly what they did at the Ambassador Bridge and in British Columbia and in Alberta. But they had to first scrape together all of the police resources to do it. And they had to devise a plan on how they were going to execute, you know, the deoccupation or whatever you want to call it. And so a lot of people, when you try to tell them this, like, hey, we need a plan here because the, you know, the cops are coming. Like, they're not just going to let us do this forever. Like, eventually they're going to send in the riot squad. And people would say, oh, you're, you know, blackpilling or don't fearmonger, or, you know, a lot of people had a lot more faith in the police then. You know, they didn't think they would do that. A lot of people were having pleasant interactions with the police in downtown Ottawa because, you know, Canadians are friendly. And so they were just trying to be like polite and go about it in the most agreeable way possible, where you're not, you know, hucking stuff at the police officers or, you know, shouting abuse at them or anything like this. And so they got caught off guard. They didn't think that the police would turn on them the way that they did. They thought that the police, when push came to shove, would join them. And they were wrong. They were wrong. And I think the reason I bring that up is because those group chats really cemented that for a lot of people. Seeing the way they were talking about these protests really told people what police are actually like. When the decision is difficult, they chose money and their jobs over the people and their oaths. So that was a wake up call for a lot of Canadians, at least when it came to police relations.
And this is just one example of how COVID really stretched the social fabric, because people would have wanted and to have a healthy relationship with the police force. They would have assumed that they did have that, and then to learn that you actually don't is really it's a bummer.
That was so, like, for 2 years. I mean, people were very patient with the police. You know, they put up with a lot from the police and their insanity for 2 years. And the crazy thing is, I like to say that there are two pillars, right, that hold up the regimes in any respective, you know, Western country right now. One is the media and the other is the police. Those are the two pillars that hold it up. The media will never change. The media is never going to turn against the regime in any meaningful way. Because if they do, then they would have to admit that they've been lying the entire time. And admitting that they've been lying to you the entire time is a death sentence to them in and of itself. So they're stuck in the lie. There's no way out for them. The police, I find interesting, because I still think that people would forgive them. I think if we use the UK as an example, that if there was another, you know, if there was more scenes like what we saw across England over the summer, and the police were to, you know, put down the batons and cross the line and join the protesters, I think that they would be welcome, despite all of what they've done to the people, all of the insanity, all of the, you know, the Facebook post arrests and the, you know, breaking down their doors for, you know, social media, or, you know, arresting guys for having the wrong books or posting stickers or any of this stuff. I think for some reason people will forgive the police if they just join them. I don't know what it is. The media doesn't have that. So it really does come down to it. If the police would just, I was trying to tell them this, I was talking to them in Ottawa, and I'm telling them, like, hey, you know, if you guys just make the right decision now, like, people are going to forgive you, right? Like, they're not going to hold it against you. And they made the wrong decision. And now it's getting harder and harder to forgive them.
Yeah, yeah. I think part of that might be that people see the police as ordinary people. Yes. They're just ordinary people who happen to be wearing a uniform, but they earn roughly the same as us. They have the same lifestyle as us. They have the same problems as us. So they're just us. So therefore, there shouldn't be any big divide. Whereas they see the news, the media, especially the news anchors, everyone knows that they earn a fortune. So they have a different, I think there's more of a natural divide there. So, and then when you get to the executives and the producers and the commissioning editors and the director generals and so on, they're very different. So it's a sort of class thing, maybe.
Yeah, I think
people assume that they are already very detached from ordinary people.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think it's, if you think about the type of, you know, man in particular that becomes a police officer, he's somebody that you can probably relate to. He's probably like, outside of the uniform, he's probably a pretty down to earth guy. He's probably, you know, whatever. If he's into sports, he's, you know, likes a beer. Like, he's an average Joe, right? When he puts on the uniform, you know, so like, this is why they're easier to relate to than the media, who are this absolutely revolting academic professional class, like, that nobody can relate to and everybody despises. Everybody of a working class background, you know, almost unanimously despises. So there's part of that. That, however, in Canada, there is police officers are not exactly working class. They're some of the highest paid police officers in Canada. And the perfect example of this was, you know, a month after the Freedom Convoy, I think it was a month anyways, maybe it was two, the federal government gave the RCMP a 24% raise. So after they systematically beat and trampled, you know, Canadian citizens, they were then awarded with a little, here's a little treat for your good work there, dogs. So, yeah, it's becoming harder. And there's a greater and greater divide. The police are basically at least upper middle class, but, you know, most of them are upper class. They're making especially at the RCMP level with overtime, they're making more than $200,000 a year. So they're wealthy people that have a lot to lose. Let's just put it that way. It's not like walking away from a carpentry job where you can go pick up another carpentry job with a contractor who's, you know, more amenable to your political views. It doesn't exist in policing, right? You're out. And now you have to earn your way like every other Canadian does in the private sector, which is awful. It's awful, right? The public sector of all, you know, variety, whether it's policing or bureaucracy or anything like that, is much more lucrative than the private sector, and you do a lot less for your trouble. So, I can understand to an extent why people lament having to, or you know, the thought of giving up these cushy jobs that they have with these amazing pensions and benefits and all this stuff. But again, that's why part of the problem here is that I think it's 20-something percent, maybe it's more at this point, but of Canadians are employed by the federal government. It's insane.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that brings us to the figure of Justin Trudeau. And as I said, I think with the trucker convoy, I want to just draw that equivalency again with Starmer and the riots, where you had this sense of that he had total contempt for these people. They're the ordinary people, the sort of salt of the earth, Joe Public and all this. And you've got this leader who just seems to despise them and is not interested in their complaints, their grievances, not interested in taking them seriously, not interested in listening to them, communicating with them, just wants them shut up and punished, and is quite open about that. And Justin Trudeau was similar. During the trucker convoy, I remember seeing him making numerous statements about it. And he also equated them. He said that the convoy, the protesters, these truckers are racists and white supremacists and misogynists, I think he said. I can't remember. But it was something like that. So he was equating all of them with everything that is unfashionable, let's say. But either way, he clearly despised them. So to get to Justin Trudeau then, he's been in power, I think, since 2015, wasn't it?
9 years, yeah.
Because that was the famous thing, the current year. Why do this? Because it's 2015. Yeah. wonderful guy. So what would you like to say about Justin Trudeau?
Well, it's funny you bring that up because I get a lot of heat for this, but I actually, in 2015, I actually voted for the Liberals. And the reason why I voted for the Liberals in 2015 was because they were offering something that would have potentially led to real change. No, it wasn't weed. Everybody always thinks you voted for weed. No, I didn't vote for, I don't smoke weed, but they were offering proportional representation. And so you guys, I know, are familiar with this. The Australians as well have issues with this. Which is, it is almost impossible for a new party, a smaller fringe party, to gain any kind of momentum in a first past the post system. And honestly, the first party to do it in a long time is Reform. And even them, like, they're, you know, whether they get 7 or 8 seats, something like that. So, and honestly, and they're not great, right? They're even, like, you know, there's issues with them. I saw he's talked to Steve Laws yesterday, and obviously I like what he and the Homeland Party are doing. I think, like, it's really good to see. But the point I'm trying to make is that having proportional representation would have been a mechanical change in the way our government operates that could have actually allowed for some of these smaller parties that are trying to get in to have a chance. And obviously, I knew we were in trouble the moment he said exactly what you just brought up, because it's 2015. And I was just like, oh God, this is a terrible, terrible thing I've done.
I think the question that he was answering was something like, why are there so many women in the,
yes,
in the, why have you chosen so many women for your cabinet or something, yes, like that? And yes, he said, because it's 2015. And he had that wonderful, smug, effeminate way, yeah, of saying it, which we've heard so many times ever since.
Yeah, I was very concerned immediately, obviously, and maybe I should have seen that coming. But honestly, at the time I was a Libertarian Party member. There is a small Libertarian Party in Canada, and I had voted for it. I had never voted Conservative or Liberal in my, you know, adult life. Obviously, since I was able to vote, I had only voted for the Libertarians, and it's pointless. It does nothing. It doesn't give them anything. It doesn't change the situation at all. And so, you know, whenever I saw this opportunity for a mechanical change, I kind of jumped at it and, you know, thought, hey, maybe if we can just get this, then, you know, we can get out of this, you know, blue party, red party dynamic that exists, you know, basically in the entire Western world. But, you know, obviously that didn't pan out. But as for Trudeau, obviously he's terrible, but I will say this: there is not a single person in this country who has done more to radicalize Canadians than Justin Trudeau. if you're a nationalist, if you're a dissident, right, you should be thankful for Justin Trudeau, because if they had somebody who was more subtle, more nuanced, more clever, better at the job than he was, we would be really, really screwed. There would be nobody pushing back against this. And we're seeing this play out right now, which is the man who is going to become the next Prime Minister of Canada, his name is Pierre Poilievre. He's just a better version of Trudeau. He's a much better, in the same way that, you know, you get like somebody like Nigel Farage can sell civic nationalism, which is just, you know, replacement going the speed limit to the British. Pierre Poilievre can sell, you know, becoming India, but a little bit slower, and maybe we don't push so much transgenderism, and maybe we, you know, so it's just, again, this is not necessarily good. So I actually kind of, this is going to sound weird, I kind of like Trudeau being in power. He has done a lot, like everything he does, everybody pays attention. In the same way, I got a lot of heat for this as well, but a perfect example of this is Kamala and Trump, which is everybody is very happy that Trump won. And yeah, I get it. I thought it was funny too, and it's fun to laugh, and the memes are funny, and yeah, it's funny, right? It's good entertainment. That doesn't necessarily mean it's good for you, or at least, you know, for us in the long term, in the attempt, if you actually want to reclaim your nation and stop the demographic replacement and start rolling some of this stuff back, you know, he's not great, because again, the trick that they play is everybody is cheering for his policies, and his policies, if you're paying attention, are not exactly great right now. Like, even regarding the mass deportations, they're already cucking on that. They're already talking about how it's only going to be criminals with serious offenses that get deported. It's already, you know, we're going to, you know, give the DACA immunity, where it's already, everything is already the worst. And the problem with that is not that Trump is worse than Kamala. It's that if it was Kamala doing these things, the entire right would be up in arms trying to fight it, and they would be mobilizing. And because it's their guy who's doing it, they're going to applaud as it's done. They're going to applaud as Elon and Trump bring in Infinity Indians for the tech sector in America. They're going to applaud as they bring in unlimited, you know, Filipinos, because they're high quality immigrants or something like that, and they're better than the Mexicans or something. So they're going to applaud all these things that otherwise would be fought, you know, and tried at least to prevent by the right. Even war, if war broke out in the Middle East in a serious way, good luck, Kamala, selling that war to the American Midwest Republicans. Good luck. I don't think a lot of, you know, farm boys from, you know, Arkansas are going to sign up to fight in Kamala's, you know, Jeet army against the Iranians. I don't think that's going to happen. They will for Trump, though. And this is what, you know, we need to get past, which is the false prophet, the false leader is much more dangerous than the enemy. And we're seeing this with Farage. Farage is much more dangerous than Starmer, and Poilievre is much more dangerous than Trudeau. And Trump is far more dangerous than Kamala, at least how I see it.
Yeah, I completely agree. You've got this situation where people fall into complacency because they think, well, our guy's in charge, our guy's in power, therefore things must be getting better, even if we can't see them getting better, and even if we can see them getting a bit worse, that must be an illusion, that things must be getting better, or at least it's better than it would be with the other. Well, yeah, it might be slightly better, but things are still, it's just a slower pace of decline. I wish there was something I could say, like, a solution to this. I just don't know. It probably does come back to the voting system. I mean, if you assume that voting does change anything, then obviously you would want a better voting system than first past the post, because it just retards the ability of new parties to get anywhere.
Well, we've seen how it is possible to achieve. And again, it's not necessarily great, but you can see how much of an issue it's becoming in, say, Germany or Austria or some of these proportional representation countries in, you know, Central and Eastern Europe, where you have, you know, they're trying to ban the AfD. And why are they trying to ban? Because it's a little bit too far right, and they're having a little bit too much success. And the reason they're having that success is because they were able to get their foot in the door as a small party, work their way up, build credibility, build more candidates, build more, you know, party membership, all of this stuff slowly, you know, through a proportional representation system. I don't think they would have been able to do that in a first past the post system like we have. I don't think it would have been possible. I think that's why we don't have these parties. And if we do, they, you know, I'll give you an example. The fringe right-wing party in Canada is the People's Party of Canada, right? I say right-wing very loosely, but, you know, they're as close as we've got to like a nationalist party. There was just a by-election two nights ago. They got 133 votes, which was 0.08% of the vote. Like, this is, and the reason why is not because people don't agree with their policies. It's because I don't want to split the vote and elect a liberal. That's it. That's what it always comes down to. So they fear the possibility of you know, a communist getting in more than they care about actually electing somebody that represents their values. So it's, you know,
I think this is a very common problem throughout, certainly in, I mean, I hear about it all the time in Britain. Don't vote for such and such party because that will just hand it to Labour. And so people keep voting for the Conservatives. This most recent election, I think, was the first time that didn't happen, when people were so pissed off, and understandably after 14 years of the Conservatives just dismally failing to do anything. People were so pissed off for the first time that they ignored that warning and just, well, what they did was they just didn't vote. And a lot of them voted for reform. But still, Labour did still get in, as you would expect. But only with a tiny, I think it was 20% of the electorate. So it did actually, I mean, it had the effect that people have been warning about. It did hand the election to Labour. I don't know. It's a really difficult one because I think that we've got to kill this two-party system, whether it's certainly in Britain. I mean, in America, it's a different kettle of fish just because of the scales of things involved. But in Britain, and maybe in Canada as well, we need to get past this.
It's virtually the same system, right? It's a Westminster parliamentary style. It's the same. Australia's is slightly different, right? They have a little bit more of a difference than us, but ours is basically identical to the UK's. Now, the problem that people see is they see this like, well, if we, you know, look what happened. We, in the case of the recent UK elections, look what happened. We split the vote and now we've got Labour, and they see this as some kind of negative thing. I view it as a positive thing because I personally view the Conservatives, as I kind of just laid out, as much more of a threat than the left. And the reason they're more of a threat is because we're never going to achieve anything with them in the way. They have to be destroyed. They have, until we get, they are the gatekeeper. They are the ratchet in the ratchet theory. They are the ones preventing any real momentum building on the right, and they have been doing so for 60 years. They're fundamentally incapable of opposing anything because they're limited in their mindset to something that is always trying to hold the left where it is, as opposed to pushing it back. Like, you know, this is very obvious stuff if you've been paying attention at all. So if we want to win ever, we need to destroy these parties. This is why I go much harder at the Conservatives and, you know, our fringe right parties and any of these kind of gatekeeping institutions. I go way harder at them than I do at the Liberals because it's easy. It's easy to make fun of Justin Trudeau. It's easy to call him gay and that he's a bitch. Like, these are all easy things to do. What's hard is getting people to understand that the option that's being presented to them as the alternative is worse. It's worse because it's going to take you to the same destination, but it's going to make you feel real comfortable and taken care of and, you know, happy along the way. And that's the real threat. So you have to get people past that point. You have to implode these conservative parties. The GOP needs to die. The conservative part, the Tories need to die. All these parties need to die. They need to get out of the way. And anybody who steps into their shoes, like Reform or in Canada, PPC, or in Australia, One Nation, you'll notice that in trying to occupy the space that's being abandoned by the center right, they are becoming the center right. They're becoming no different than the parties they seek to replace. So,
but it's like putting a fresh coat of paint on something that's old and rubbish. Yeah. I can't think of the expression. Okay, so it's reform, but the only thing you can say about reform is it's not the Conservative Party. Yeah, sure, but it might as well be. At this point, but this is the problem. People do think, well, it's not the Conservatives. It is new. It's a new party. So it's exasperating because then that starts the whole thing all over again. So now we've got another bunch of cucks, traitors, in government potentially.
Yeah, I think names matter, and I think it's very interesting that they chose reform. Now, we had a reform party in Canada at one point as well, which was, again, an attempt to usurp the Conservative Party. And I think it's very interesting that they choose that name, because to me, reform is what conservatism is at this point. They don't actually want to change the system. They don't actually want to fundamentally have any kind of like upheaval within the way the system functions. They want to occupy the space that exists already within the system. And they want to be taken seriously. You see this a lot with Farage. Like, I'm not super well versed in him, but I always get the impression that he doesn't actually want to shake up the system. He just wants to be part of it. He sees his way into it, and he wants to be respected and treated like he's one of them. And that you see the same thing with all these conservatives. They don't actually care about reforming the system. They care about reforming the Conservative Party into something that can actually win so that they can get in. So,
well, isn't it true that the Reform Party in Canada actually ended up merging with the Conservative Party?
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, you see, the thing is with reform, I don't even know what that would mean, what that would signify. If like Farage is reform, if they merge with the Conservative Party, I mean, it's just a complete nothing burger. It doesn't, who cares? Well, what difference does, how are things now different? So, because they are so similar. I don't know how you would differentiate the two, except that one of them has Nigel Farage involved. And the thing is that he is very popular. He, as an individual, is a very magnetic sort of figure. I think he's been good at pretending to be anti-system, anti-establishment, whatever. He's been good at coming across as a, not radical, but a spanner in the works. And so now that he actually has the chance to be that, you're seeing him instead relaxing into being a mere reformer. Well, not even a reformer. He just wants to join the system. And I don't know how you could... I mean, it might just be something that about the allure of power. Once it becomes so close, you just think, well, fuck it. I won't bother trying to beat it. I'll just join it. It's so enticing. I think that really, in the case of Farage, he was never radical, to be honest.
You see it all the time. Like, is it the Swedish Democrats? Like, they started out as, weren't they, I'm pretty sure they were the offshoot of the Swedish Nazi Party, right?
Or I don't know, but I do remember them, that they were quite a radical. Yeah.
Yeah. In their earliest days, I think they were founded by somebody who was part of the original, whatever Nazi leadership in Sweden. And over time they got less and less radical, to the point where they are now, or I don't know if they're the majority, but I know they're part of the current government in Sweden, and they are center right conservative. They're indistinguishable from any other center right party that exists in the wider European world. So, like, this is something that you see over and over again, is you get these parties sometimes that start out and they have a good message. We're seeing this happen right now with the PPC. They have a good message. They have a pretty good platform. They have a little bit of energy behind them. And then slowly in order to gain popularity, they will cuck on their messaging, and they will, slowly dilute until there's no substance to what they're pushing anymore. And it's very obvious that they don't actually believe in it. It's just the message that there is just their marketing. Right. And I see this with, obviously, reform. You see this with, like, MAGA is another good example. Just the MAGA kind of mentality in general, same thing. Like, everything that they claimed they believed in 2015, 2016 seems to no longer apply. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, and also just in the space of a few months. I mean, now that he's won the election, it's like, okay, now we don't need mass deportations.
Yep.
It's just awful. Same thing again with Marine Le Pen in France.
Perfect example.
It's more and more, she's just cucking and cucking and cucking, and becoming ever more respectable and palatable to the normie public, who really are just out to lunch. They're asleep. Let's just say that. It's that type of person who doesn't realize how much change is needed. And they don't want to realize, they want to believe that, we just need a stricter asylum policy or something like that.
I think fundamentally what it comes down to is that the conservative mindset is one that's fixated on what is possible within the current existing cultural conditions. And so they look at the way, you know, the lay of the land as it currently sits, and they go, well, we're never going to win a battle here, so we might as well, you know, retreat or surrender, or we might as well make a concession. Maybe we can negotiate a better standing. Whereas a nationalist or a, you know, a more revolutionary type looks at the lay of the land and goes, how am I going to turn this into something that I can actually achieve victory in? And so they will always alter their message to suit, you know, the current conditions. Whereas people like us are more focused on how do we change the culture so that it creates the conditions in which, you know, our desired victory conditions can be achieved. And so this is the fundamental difference between, say, like something like Homeland and Reform. Reform is looking at how it currently sits, and they're going like, well, we're never going to win if we attack Islam, and we're never going to win if we talk about remigration, and we're never going to win if we, you know, and that's their mindset. That's why they, you know, they don't do those things. Whereas you get an actual nationalist party like Homeland, and they say, okay, look, we're not going to win by talking about remigration now, but how do we change it? How do we convince the people that this is the right way to go? And how do we go about making this message something that sells to the public? And so they're trying to change the public to suit their message instead of their message to suit the public, which is what you need, obviously.
And it's how the left implemented all of their change. In fact, the public were often irrelevant because they gained the power and then they were able to just institute gay marriage, for example.
Yep.
Whether the public were up for it or not. So it's a completely different mindset. And of course, I understand that the left had power. The point is they had institutional power so that they could do that. I think for us, those are the two options, really. Those are the two. That's the fork in the road. You can either try to gain institutional power so that we can change the culture in that way, or we can try to persuade the public, no, don't get complacent. Society is dying. Western civilization is dying. We really need radical change. So yeah, I think that's the dilemma.
See, I think the answer to the question, like I don't really care about the establishment political system anymore at all. I see them as essentially irrelevant. And the reason I see them as irrelevant is because I've watched over the past 3 years and, you know, to a certain extent personally, how much you can change the culture if you approach it the right way and if you just stick to your guns. And I think it's pretty obvious at this point that the far right, the, you know, nationalist, ethno-nationalist, ethnocentric, white identitarian right is actually dominating the discourse, at least within the right-wing politics. We've shown that, like, it's ultimately our rhetoric that becomes the dominant, the most important friction point between different factions on the right. It always comes back to this, and you see this played out a lot. I saw it a lot with Steve Laws over the summer in the UK, where he was having debates with these civic nationalists and he was destroying them. He's destroying them and he's slowly winning people over. And it's, you know, a good way to think about this is right now, if you're on the right and you say something that's, or, you know, the so-called right, if you're a conservative and you say something that's anti-white or kind of cucked, you're going to get dogpiled. You're going to get destroyed. You're going to have, it's starting to change to the point where it's not the left canceling the conservatives anymore. It's the far right canceling the conservatives. And they're the ones, you know, starting to, you know, the way I like to think about it is I want these politicians, I want these influencers, I want these whatever content creators, I want them to fear us more than they fear the left. I want them to fear what we're going to say about them more than what the media is going to say about them. And you're starting to see this, like, I want, you know, these politicians to think twice before they, you know, pander to Indians because of how it's going to reflect in the media, of how it's going to, you know, result in backlash against them. And that is starting to happen. So I think there is a shift going on, and I think that it's kind of proven that you can have more influence from the far right just by applying political pressure on these parties, on these politicians, on these influencers, than you can by trying to achieve institutional power through the conventional system. Because you're always going to be barred from it. They're always going to try to keep you out of it. So now, I don't think that necessarily means that endeavors like the Homeland Party are you know, irrelevant and that you shouldn't do them. It's just, it depends on your mindset in approaching it. Like, if you're the Homeland Party, are you trying to win seats or are you trying to shape culture? Because you can win seats after you shape the culture. So that should be your primary focus.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea to make their position, the position of center-right, cucky conservative types, to make their position untenable, or at least uncomfortable. So when they, and I remember, I'm kind of boasting here, but I think we've all done this for years. So I'll just say that I've done it for years. I remember about 3 or 4 years ago, I was on Twitter and some politician said something. I responded, and then that got really, we ratioed him, as it's termed. And it is really fun. I mean, it's a nice feeling to embarrass them, to hold them to account and say, why are you betraying us? Why are you betraying your people? Why are you betraying your country? And just make it, because they were obviously doing it hoping for a sort of dopamine high of I'll get warm fuzzies for doing this. I'll get a pat on the fucking head for selling out my people. So if you instead give them the opposite, I think, well, it's what they deserve, apart from anything else.
Yes.
I mean, to me, a traitor is, well, I agree with that famous phrase, you know. I think that a politician, obviously, I'm not going to Fed post. I'm just saying they should be verbally punished when they do this kind of thing. They shouldn't be allowed to feel good about it when they do this, because it is just treachery.
Make politicians afraid again.
Yeah. So well, what's the alternative? You just sit back and let them, you know, get their plaudits for betraying us.
They were kind of protected for like Twitter. You can say what you want about Elon Musk, and obviously there's a lot of things I don't like about him, but I think it's undeniable that there's been a huge change that's directly a result of him kind of even just opening it up as much as he has, which is not, you know, it's obviously it's not the Wild West, but it's closer to it than it was. And
it's enough to make this, to cause this exodus to blue sky.
Yeah. Well,
I think that in a way we should, and I've said this before about other things, you should trust what your enemies do. You know, if they don't want you to have something, that means you should want that thing.
Yes.
If they want something for you, that means it's bad for you. If they are running away to blue sky, that probably does mean that Twitter is now a much more free space for us. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing that. Yeah. I don't think it's just performative. I think they really are genuinely uncomfortable in a situation, in a platform where they can be held to account. They're not used to it.
I mean, they had a nice little break, obviously, from roughly 2016 to 2022, where, you know, they weren't being, was it 2022 or 2020? Anyways, whenever Elon bought it, but I mean,
yeah, it was 22. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, it is fun. It is fun watching like how easy it is. As you said, it's fun to ratio a politician. It's fun to just, and you can do it so easily too. A lot of the time, all it takes is like two words, you know, a couple 4-letter words, and that's all, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it is fun, because the thing is, a lot of them don't have much of an organic base of support. So you can reply to them, retweet your reply, people come in and they see it, and then it is actually a sort of ritual humiliation for them. And again, I don't actually like the idea of humiliating people, except when they're traitors, except when they clearly deserve it.
Yeah. Well, so that's what makes it so fun.
Exactly. These are people being bad. If not bad, if not actual bad people, full stop. So yeah, they deserve it. All right. Is there anything else that you'd like to say about the current state of Canada? Because that is what we were going to talk about.
Honestly, it's
very open question. I know.
It's everything gets progressively worse in Canada the same way as it is everywhere else. And the reason that it keeps getting progressively worse is because nobody's actually taking the initiative to get involved. Everybody's waiting for somebody else to do it for them.
Okay, so then I'll ask a better question. What do you want from people?
What I want from people is, so unlike a politician, I don't want your vote. I want your soul. And that sounds bad, but I mean it in a good way. I want your soul in this fight. I want your head in this fight. I want your time and your energy in this fight. I don't care who you check X on the ballot for at the voting box anymore. It doesn't matter. There's too many people that are expecting that to be the solution, or even worse, as you know, I don't know if you've seen this. They're expecting Donald Trump or America to come save them from big bad Trudeau. It's pathetic. We need to, as Canadians, but honestly, as you know, white people in general in the Western world, we need to get away from this idea that the politicians are going to save us. So in whatever capacity it is, I like to say that I want 1% of your time. If you're a nationalist, I want 1% of your time devoted to IRL organization and you know, institution building, which is like 7 hours a month. 7 hours a month. I mean, if you want to go waking time only, fine. 4 hours a month. That's all I want of your time and energy. And this is why we've started our organization. It launched recently. It's called Second Sons Canada. And you can find it at secondsons.org if you're a Canadian and you're interested in this. And what it is it's a nationalist organization for men. The reason being is because we've seen that what's truly lacking, and you know, if you want to use the convoy as an example here, it's a good one. What was truly lacking from the convoy was organization. Now, people were very effective at getting, you know, what, you know, getting fuel where it needed to go and all working together. But imagine what that would have looked like if there was actual leadership, if there was an actual, you know, chain of logistics, if there was actual structure to what was going on down there. Was none. That was pure anarchy, like in the good sense of where, you know, people just come together and they just do what they have to do. But it wasn't a machine, and there was no leadership, and there was no trust this is one thing.
The left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing.
Exactly. And so that led to issues where people didn't know what to do, and nobody was in charge and nobody was in control. And that has its advantages, but it obviously has disadvantages too. And as we saw, it's very easy for them to just start picking people off one by one whenever there's no structure, organization, or institution backing up these things. And so instead of waiting for somebody to come along and do this again, we're trying to actively create the conditions where basically we're preparing for these kinds of inevitabilities. Like a good example of this again is the UK. Like we saw how that played out. You get, you know, what happened with these protests that devolved into mostly peaceful protests in the summer. There was no organization behind it. There was no leadership. There was nobody controlling it. There was nobody speaking for it. There was, you know, and that's the problem, is you have this good, righteous, angry energy behind these things, and it just dissipates into the void and into, you know, unconstructive activities, like, you know, as we saw. So this is where you need these people. And obviously there's a huge risk to that. And we've seen how it plays out in the UK. Like, I would not want to be the leader of an organization in the UK, because you are going to be targeted extremely heavily. So maybe political parties are the best way to go about that in the UK. I don't know. But as we've seen in other places, you know, these organizations are starting to have some real impact. And I'm a big fan of people like Thomas Rousseau and Patriot Front. These guys are doing an excellent job of building an organization, positive messaging, good stock in their membership, and they're becoming a legitimate alternative if you're tired of the political system, there's something out there. Like, if you want to get involved, there it is. So, you know, that's essentially what we're trying to build now in Canada. That's my take on Canada, is we need more good men to actually get involved in organizing at the grassroots level and building upward momentum, as opposed to expecting one of these political parties to just show up and fix everything for us, because they're not going to. So.
All right. Somebody said, Ferry walks the walk and has total Chad energy, no homo. Nice summary there. Yes. All right. Ethno says, support our folk. Thank you very much. Darby, is there any possibility for remigration to take off in Canada post-Bernier or the PPC? I know the Overton window has shifted in places like Europe and Australia.
I mean, there's a huge desire for mass deportations, remigration, whatever you want to call it. I think more than half or almost half of Canadians support mass deportations now, and more than three quarters of Canadians want an end to mass immigration. I forget what it was. I think it was two thirds want a moratorium. So again, you have this slot. It's like three out of four or four out of five people in Canada that are tired of mass immigration and they want it to end. And then you have within that three quarters of the population, you have this sliding scale of, you know, everything from deport every last one of them to maybe we just, you know, cool it, you know, drop the numbers for a bit. So it's a very, you know, wide range of people that you're going to have in the anti-immigration camp. I think a lot more of them would be a lot more aggressive against immigration if we had some real leadership that was actually getting down to the real reasons why you don't want mass immigration. And this is something that every conservative party cucks on when it comes down to it, which is they can't just say that Canada should remain a white majority. It should have always remained a white majority. It was founded with that intention. Virtually every prime minister for the first 100 years of this country's existence was a white nationalist. You know, you can go look at the quotes and the history of what they believed, of what all of these men that are held, you know, by conservatives in high regard, you know, actually believe, but for some reason they disagree with their beliefs. It's funny how that works. But I think it's possible, but I don't think it's possible through political parties like Maxime Bernier's People's Party of Canada or the Conservative Party of Canada. And the reason why is because they fundamentally can't say what they actually want. It's always argued through an economic lens. It's always argued through an infrastructure lens, a housing lens. It's always something to do with money, basically money and resources. And until these parties can get past that and say, no, fundamentally the main problem with immigration from non-European countries is that it alters the genetic stock, it alters the ethnic character of the country and basically turns it into something else. And until they can make that argument, they're just arguing over dollars. And obviously the problem with arguing over dollars is that it invites all of these kind of academic discussions that go off into the weeds, and you'll get some guy with his hands together going, actually, it's good for the economy if we let in a lot of immigrants. We've shown that it bolsters our economy and it drives up the housing. So you end up arguing about whether or not it's good for the economy as opposed to whether or not it's good for Canadians, which is a completely different discussion. Until they can get past that, we're never going to see remigration. And that's why my goal is to make that the conversation, as opposed to, like, look, obviously it's bad for housing, it's bad for infrastructure, it's bad for the economy. Obviously all these things are true, but it's not the strongest argument. And all of those arguments are irrelevant if you understand that a nation that's reliant on immigration is fundamentally a failing nation. If you can't exist without importing endless foreigners into your country, you're failing. So there's clearly something else that needs to be addressed.
Exactly. If you need to continually renew yourself with foreigners, then you're simply doing something wrong. And we
you're
are.
Lying.
Yeah, exactly. I also have this meme that quite aptly sums up the mentality, which is quite a funny one. But that is the mentality of the civic nationalist.
Yes.
As retarded as it seems. So, yeah. Okay. And then was there something I was going to pick up on there? No, I just agree. I think that all of all this stuff about the economy, the problem is that you can make an economic argument for anything at all. And this is what they do. And this is what they have been doing. They'll say that immigration's great for the economy. We need this. We need that. Oh, actually, they don't take welfare more than the natives. In fact, it's the opposite. The natives do. Blah, 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 blah. And you can just, there's always a way. If that is your... If your priority is the economy, then that priority can be used to manipulate you into accepting just about anything.
This is, again, one of the ways I like to explain this to people are everybody has that uncle, right? Or grandfather or whatever, you know, friend of your dad, like maybe it's your dad, that guy who just fundamentally is like, you know, the kind of racist one, the one who always kind of like, you know, he'd see the clerk at the store and he's just like, yeah, these fucking people. Like, you know, that guy. The reason why you should appeal to that person on that level is because that's the one thing that's instinctive. That's just there. That was always there. The reason they think like that is because it's something that comes very natural to them. Now, if you get these academic types, they'll get in their ear and they can make all these kind of arguments about how, well, you know, you may not like him, but it's good for the economy and it's like all of these things, but they can never get rid of that instinct. That's the one thing that they can't get out of. And so when you appeal to that, you say, actually, you know, it's okay to just not like these people and not want more of these people in your country. That's totally fine because it's your country. It's for your people. And why would you want it to be changed into something else? That's why it's the most powerful argument, because if you tap into that just gut instinct that most people, frankly, have when it comes to foreigners, there's nothing they can do to convince them that it's that there's a good reason. Once you get past all of these superficial arguments about, I don't know, the easiest way I like to say it is I'd rather live through a Great Depression than a Great Replacement. I'd rather live through the Great Depression lasted 10 years. Okay, the Great Replacement is forever. Like I'm fine with, you know, and once you start making that argument in that those terms with people, a lot of them tend to get it. They understand that, you know, actually the economy is not going to be good forever. And if we base, you know, our expectations of the economy remaining good on endless immigration, I mean, that's just going to result in us being brown, and eventually the economy is going to suck anyways, because endless growth is a fantasy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and just look at brown countries. I mean, the economy is dreadful. So,
I mean, a really good example of this is like Canada's population has grown so fast due to immigration that we've entered a population trap. I'm not going to get into this, like go off into the weeds about it, but a population trap is something that occurs in third world countries that have massive population spikes due to insane birth rates. So like basically the countries that are currently experiencing population traps are like Nigeria, the Congo, Canada, and I don't know, there's like a few other. It's like Canada, the first world country in a population trap, which means your population's growing faster than GDP can keep up with. And basically it means your standard of living is going down because the population, there's not enough wealth, there's not enough jobs, there's not enough anything to keep up with the rate at which the population is growing. So yeah, you'll see this on graphs. You'll see the G7, all the other countries, this slow, you know, incline in GDP in Canada is doing this thing where it's teetering over the edge, and it directly correlates with mass immigration. But again, the economic arguments, they're not as powerful as just saying, yeah, but I don't like Indians because they smell. That works way better. That works way better with the average Canadian. They stink. And they're like, yeah, they do. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I don't like them. And they're like, yeah, I don't like them either.
They're different from us. That's all that should need to be said. There's no reason whether they smell like roses or whatever. It doesn't matter. They are not us. And I think that's the fundamental thing. I mean, the instinct, I think you're absolutely right. everyone, even the hipster, the progressive, they white flight. I mean, they don't live by their principles, their professed principles. They vote with their feet, and they get out of diversity whenever possible, whether it's where they live or even the whole cafeteria test at work. People prefer their own. It's the old thing, you know, birds of a feather flock together. This is just human nature. Everyone is subject to it. Everyone has this. So, yeah, I agree. If you appeal to that, you can get through to them.
This is something that we are seeing a lot of in Canada right now, which is more and more people are being affected by it just in small ways, whether it's they live in an area where now it's nothing but, like, obviously Indian immigration is the big one in Canada right now. Like, it's over like half of the immigrants coming to Canada are Indian or something. So it's out of control. But you're seeing this, like, these Reddit is amazing for this. You go into any local city Reddit subreddit, and there'll be people who are complaining about the Indians, and it's like they don't understand. I think what the a lot of these, they're not the insane leftists. They're more of like the liberal leaning center left types. I think what a lot of them confused is that they like novelty, not multiculturalism, which is a huge difference. You know, novelty is the ability to go to a Chinese restaurant, and
it's the incredible range of restaurants thing. Yeah. It's that I want to have a different dish every night of the week. Yeah. But in order to get that, I'll say that I want all these different cultures around me, but they actually don't.
Yeah,
if they did, they would partake of these cultures. But the truth is that hipsters, they don't know a damn thing about foreign cultures. It's nonsense, complete affectation.
But that's exactly it. So, like, the example that I like to use is, you see this a lot with they're not the insane rabid leftists, but the left-leaning, you know, white woman who loves novelty, loves being able to, whatever. She likes yoga classes, and she'll go to the Diwali parade or whatever. And she likes, it's new, it's different. It's, oh my God, I feel so cultured. Like, it's that. And then whenever they're in a situation where now you're surrounded by 10 Indian men and they're leering at you on a bus, you don't like multiculturalism so much anymore, do you? You start to understand that that's not actually what you liked. It was novelty. It was something different. That's what you liked. And you don't actually want to live in that difference. You just want to be able to experience it once in a while. Like we all do. We all enjoy a little bit of difference from time to time. That doesn't mean you should suicide your entire nation in the process. Like, this should be pretty simple.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of common sense. All right. Enlightened Despot said, great work, Ferryman. I raise a Diagolon salute to you. Are you planning another tour to drive the Laurential Elite, MSM, and Normies mad? Hope to catch it next time.
Yes. So what he's referring to, obviously, is, I don't know if you're familiar with Diagolon. Maybe Jeremy can get into that.
I've heard of it, but I don't know what it is.
So Diagolon started with Jeremy, and basically it's a fictitious country that runs from a diagonal line, Alaska to Florida. And the idea was that if you mapped out those states and provinces, this kind of like white diagonal line, they were the ones that were like opposed to the COVID nonsense. So basically Canada's conservative Western provinces, and then the American Northwest, Midwest, and Southwest, right? They kind of fought that stuff. So it was just like a meme country, basically. It was like our version of Kekistan. And it took off because Jeremy has a big fan base. And so we started referring to ourselves as, like, you know, the Empire of Diagolon. And, you know, we just had fun with it. Eventually they, you know, the media got a hold of this, and they were presenting it as if it was something that we were actually trying to create, like some kind of white ethno state that runs from Alaska to Florida, and that we were going to overthrow the Canadian government. And so they bring it up in Parliament all the time, you know, at least, you know, every now and then anyways. Trudeau mentioned Diagolon recently again, whenever he was attacking the Conservative Party leader. It's just not, like, obviously it's nonsense. it's a joke country, but they take it very seriously. So we did a there's obviously, as I said, a collection of streamers that kind of all orbit around each other, and we did a tour this summer that was 17 stops across the country. Jeremy, Derek Rance, and myself, and Jeremy's partner Morgan. So yeah, that's what he was referring to. Would we do it again? To answer his question, I don't really want. That was a lot. That was a month away, and just it was tiring. It was a lot to do in a month. So, but it was fun, and people enjoyed it, and it drove the media and the academic class nuts. So obviously, every chance we get to troll them or just irritate them, I love doing it. So I could be tempted, I guess, into doing it again.
All right. Okay. It does sound fun. Kevin said we should start the Loyalist Party of Canada.
There is a Loyalist Party of Canada. I don't know if it's officially registered, but there's a guy who has that handle on Twitter. And I think I actually met him on the tour, the guy who has that party. I'm mixing up two guys though. I actually, if somebody was going to start a political party, which I have no interest in, I don't have the temperament for politics. I don't want to be a politician. I don't like politicians. I don't like politics really, other than, you know, I engage in it because it's kind of a necessity, but I don't really want to be doing this to be perfectly frank. Like, I was enjoying my life. And I would happily go back to that. You know, the if we achieve some kind of acceptable victory conditions, I would just go back to what I was doing, designing houses. Like, I would just quit. So I don't really want to be doing this. But if somebody was to start a political party in Canada, I would probably use the Homeland branding. I would contact the Homeland Party, and I would do an offshoot of it and in unison with it. I think there's probably something to that. I think, like, even if you understand, like, it's very Canadian. Obviously, our two major parties were named because of the initial, you know, we have the Tories too, right? The Tories and the Grits, like, it came from the, you know, the same political system. So I think having that unison between Canada and the UK is something that would be good. And I think that this is a wider topic, but I think there's, I think a lot of good could be had by reuniting these kind of nationalist ties with the United Kingdom. Canada has become very Americanized. We romanticize American history as opposed to appreciating our connections to the British Empire and British history. I'm sure Fortisax talked a lot about this too. He's really good on this topic, but, Canadians need to stop romanticizing American history, and it's not ours. Obviously, the proximity kind of just, and you know, the weight of American culture kind of does that to us. But I think if we rediscovered our roots, we would have an appreciation for it, and we would understand that it's actually quite interesting. It's something to be proud of, not something to be. You know, loyal she begins, loyal she remains. That's the motto of the province of Ontario. I don't think that's a lot of Canadians view that as something negative, like this kind of connection to the British Empire. They have even the flag behind me. A lot of Canadians love the shield, but they can't stand the Union Jack. And I don't really understand that. They associate the Union Jack with the crown, and they really don't like the crown. And I don't see that. I see England, Scotland, Wales, and North Ireland. I don't see the crown on there, but for whatever reason, Canadians do. So anyways, I think using the Homeland Party and building up that affiliation would be a good process to undergo.
Yeah, I think you might be right. I'd certainly agree about strengthening the ties between different countries. Absolutely. Okay, and then Mustache said, happy millennial. I hope all is well with you, Colin. This is the first millennial I have caught this year. Shout out to Ferry. It was great to meet you and the boys in Alberta.
Yeah, I must have been on the tour as well.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that super chat. And then there were a few from elsewhere. Telital said something. I don't want to read it out because I don't know what it means. So I'm not going to take the risk. Okay. But he said, long live Diagolon. And then he also said, we've got our own Stasi here in Canada. Paramilitary force dressed up like they're going to invade Poland. I will never unsee what they did to good Canadians. Fuck all of them. I think that was when we were talking about COVID.
Yeah, it's that sentiment's pretty strong among the Canadian right at this point. They really don't like the police anymore. I'm sure very similar to the UK, I'm sure.
Yeah. And then cocaine... This guy's calling himself Cocaine Rim Job.
he's a good guy.
Right, okay. A good way to gauge progress is the number of months, weeks between Ferry's talking points on stream and mainstream political narratives in the public sphere. It's getting closer. All right. And then Henry said, I'll have to watch the replay, but it's great to see Ferry added to Millennial. Thank you. Black Pigeon Pilled, I notice behind Ferry is a delightful Canadian red ensign. Is there much loyalism left in your country to see it return as the official flag again? Well, you've already addressed that, but what would you think? Do you think that will ever become the official flag again?
I think that it's my belief that if we were to achieve victory, that is what would happen. If Canadian nationalists were to actually succeed in reclaiming the country, that would occur. And the reason why I believe that is because everybody who is of that persuasion, almost like with a few exceptions, is basically on board with this. Now, this flag was replaced almost 60 years ago. It will be 60 years ago this February that they replaced the flag behind me with the, you know, yeah, current red maple.
1965, yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's pretty obvious why they did that in hindsight. I think that if you look at the current Canadian flag, a lot of people like it. It's obviously very recognizable. It's very distinct. And so that obviously those are good things when it comes to a flag. But when you look at it objectively and you think about it for a second, you'll understand that it's a corporate logo. There's very little, you know, that calls to our history in that flag. It was designed to be aesthetically pleasing and not as something that actually represents our history and our heritage and our legacy. And the flag behind me is a very explicit call to ethno-nationalism or at least, you know, ethnic identity. As you can see, there's the English lions, the Scottish lion, the French fleur-de-lis, and the harp of Erin on that flag, as well as the three maple leaves to represent, you know, Canada uniting them. And so understanding that that is the reason why they removed that flag, and that the flag behind me actually is the flag of the Canadian people. While it may not be the flag of the Canadian state, it is the flag of the Canadian people, and it's something that's growing in popularity. I have a Telegram channel that I operate called Operation Ensign, specifically about this, and I think they've gifted us a uniquely powerful symbol in this fight that a lot of other nations and a lot of other nationalists that are currently going through this don't necessarily have, which is, this was our flag for 100 years. This for more than 100 years, this was the flag of British North America and the Canadian territory, which became the Canadian nation. And they took that from us and they gave us a corporate logo, and it's waved by Indians, wave it at their protests, and Israelis wave it at their protests. Not so much the Muslims don't necessarily wave it. They like to light it on fire, but it's something that gets co-opted and used by all of these groups. But the one thing you will never see them try to co-opt is the one behind you. And the reason behind me, and the reason why, is because it is an explicit call to an ethnic identity. And so they gifted us this symbol. We understand the power behind it. They understand the power behind it. That's why they got rid of it. That's because it would never have worked in a multicultural society to have something that explicit. So
no, it doesn't work.
Yeah. So it's very obvious in hindsight why they got rid of it. And I think promoting it and pushing it as the symbol of the Canadian people in opposition to the Canadian state is something that we should engage in. And people need to just get over the fact that the Union Jack is on it.
Yeah.
Which is the biggest objection, honestly, to it. A lot of people like the idea of removing the Union Jack and centering the shield in the middle. I disagree. I like the Union Jack. I think it's aesthetically one of the best flags on earth. And also it's our heritage. I don't know, again, why Canadians are so desperate to distance themselves from their own heritage and arguably the greatest empire the world has ever seen. Like, why are you ashamed of that? It's something that you should be proud of. But anyways, I'm working on it. I'm working on it with Canadians. So.
Okay. And then Telital said, expect a self-rescue. I don't know quite what that means, but thank you.
Yeah, it's just a reference to nobody's coming to save you.
Oh, yes. Yeah, right. Okay.
So you got to figure it out yourselves, yeah.
Yeah. And then Black Pigeon Pilled asked, what's your take on George Grant?
George Grant.
Yeah, I know that. I recognize the name, but I can't remember. All right, okay. I don't think that's a Canadian philosopher, university professor, and social critic.
I'm honestly not familiar. I'll have to look into him.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Black Pigeon Pilled. Sorry about that we can't answer it. And then what? One Mia One, Merry Christmas all. Let there be blue and green eyes in 100 years. That's a lovely sentiment, and I certainly share it.
Thanks, Mia.
Andy said, should there be more flash mob protests like in Hamilton, Ontario, with the Mass Deportations Now banner?
100%. We plan on doing them. So what he's referring to is a small demonstration of, I think there was like 15 guys. In Hamilton, Ontario recently, all they did was they did black block and they held up a sign that said mass deportations now, and it went viral. One thing that we're discovering, and a few individuals like the guys in Australia, Patriot Front, there's a few others, they're showing how to make modern political demonstrations valuable and feasible again. And a lot of people, especially if you were involved in any of the COVID protests, you'll see that they were done terribly. They were done in a way that the media just ignores. And if they get so big that they can't ignore them, they just send the police in or they quarantine. Like, you know, it's not an effective way of protesting. And what we've seen by some of these small groups is that instead of trying to gather as many people as you can in one area and then yelling at empty buildings, which is typically how these protests go, by organizing a few small guys and doing it in a way that is controversial and kind of shocking and something that people aren't used to seeing, you can generate millions and millions of views through the media. Basically, the media does exactly what you want them to. Just by having a controversial message and, you know, carrying yourselves in a way that people aren't used to seeing. And so, like, Patriot Front has mastered this. With 50 guys, they can have the entire internet abuzz for a week. And, you know, that's how they get their message out. And so we need more of this, and it needs to be done in a way that's clever, in a way that there's a balance here, which is, you have to be offensive enough and controversial enough that the media takes the bait, while also being having a message that's optical enough that the majority of people agree with it. So mass deportations now is a perfect example of a very clever way to go about this, which is, it's enough that the media is going to bite on it because it's racist or something, and they're going to try to, you know, vilify you in the media, which is what you want. You want to be vilified in the media. In a world where, you know, pedophiles and, you know, child mutilators are, you know, perceived as good, you should be seen as the villain. If the media is turning them into the good guy, then you need to be the villain, the heel, if you want to use the wrestling analogy. So you need to be a little bit offensive, but you also have to be, you have to be seen as the outlaw good versus the lawful evil, basically. you have to be seen as the Robin Hood versus the King John. That's how you have to do this. And so there's groups that are getting very good at doing this in these flash mobs.
An interesting dynamic. Okay, Swala, I don't know how to pronounce your name, but I also don't know what it means. So you can forgive me for not reading it out. And he says, I'll keep donating even though you won't read my spicy handles. Great work and interesting guest, Woz. Well, thank you very much. All right. And Telital says, tell him what DILF is, Ferry.
DILF was our hypothetical, meme political party. So obviously Diagolon has a lot of offshoots of, it's just inside memes layered on inside memes, right? From Jeremy's fan base. And so DILF was the Diagolon Imperial Liberation Front, which was our concept for the political party.
Right. Okay. Because he mentioned that in one of the things that I wasn't sure whether to read or not. He said, give me DILF or give me death. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for explaining that. And then finally, MEMC said, ask Ferry to mention the significance of Wilfrid Laurier, our only based French-Canadian Prime Minister. Great stream. Thanks, guys. Wilfrid Laurier.
Well, I mean, Wilfrid Laurier has some spicy quotes that the left love to demonize, obviously, but this is true for most political figures, at least the very least prior to the end of the Second World War. You'll find that almost unanimously every political leader in the Western world would be white nationalist or Nazi, by today's standard anyways. So obviously Wilfrid Laurier has some spicy quotes about Negroes and stuff like that. But
I think I've heard the name before. I'm sure someone's mentioned him to me.
Well, he was our second prime minister. He was the leader of the Liberal Party, French-Canadian, obviously. And his biggest contribution, or maybe his most controversial contribution, was to the formulation of the White Canada policy. So you can dig into that.
That's part of them.
Yeah. But I mean, there's great quotes that you can use. And again, I find it interesting. So these two characters in particular, Sir John A. Macdonald, who is obviously he's perceived as being Canada's founding father. He's the architect of Confederation. And Sir Wilfrid Laurier, who was the French, father of Confederation, who kind of made this union possible, right? Because a huge part of, the issue with Confederation was getting Quebec and Ontario to agree to unite under, one banner, and how it was going to be, how the powers were going to be divided and this type of stuff, right? To ensure French cult. Anyways, both of those characters get attacked for obviously having racial preferences. Sir John A. Macdonald spoke of maintaining the Aryan character of Canada and stuff like this, in those terms, like that specific word. So it just kind of shows you the mindset of these men. But I do find it interesting that you'll get conservatives who are very upset at the left for trying to cancel these two characters. They want to take down their statues. They want to remove their names from buildings or roadways, etc. And then whenever you profess to subscribe to the ideals of these men, those same conservatives or, right-leaning people will turn around and call you evil. Because the left says that those perspectives on race and stuff are evil. So it's very fascinating to me how they just get caught up in this trap. Yeah,
this is the untenable position of the conservative. And this is how he ends up acquiescing to the left time and time again. He complains a bit about it. And then he says, yeah, okay, all right.
Yeah, it's true. If you agree that Sir John A. Macdonald and Wilfrid Laurier are racist, because they were, by modern standards, they're what you would call racist for sure. Then why are you complaining that the left wants to take down his statues? Because you agree that racism is bad and that it's evil and it's something. So why, what are you, you're the left. Yeah. Why are you even complaining about it?
Exactly. The Conservative has boxed himself into a corner there, which is what they always do. In the end, they've got no option but to acquiesce. Yeah. Oh, my God. They're just the most dreadful tacticians. I think they just don't seem to have any conception that they are playing a game and they're being played.
It's hilarious. Like, even characters like Winston Churchill, right?
Oh, don't get me started.
I know, but like, he's a perfect example of one that conservatives will go above and beyond. They'll die on the hill of defending Winston Churchill, right? But he was just as much of a racist, if not worse, than any member of the NSDAP. Like, what are you what? It makes no sense.
I know. I wrote an essay last year called Aryan Blues, where I went into all of this because I was trying to show the contradictions in as I say, it's just being a conservative, their position is untenable. And I was trying to show why that is. So, I went into it all there for anyone interested. It's on my Substack. All right. And Stephen said, I think the Swala's handle means something obscene. Also, did the guest hear of Kyle McKee from Calgary back in the day? Kyle McKee?
I'm not familiar, no.
Right, okay. And then there was one final one from Talital. He says, vote DILF. All right. Okay, well, this has been great. Very fast-paced, and I've tried to keep up with you. I hope I've done well. So is there anything you'd like to say before we finish?
Yeah, the only thing that I can say is something that I always end my streams with, which is, you know, tribe and train, which is a very simple motto, but it's what needs to happen. We need more guys to get involved in organizing at the grassroots level. And this is how we build an actual movement outside of the political system. So if you're a Canadian nationalist and you're interested, there's not just my or our organization, there's others as well. But if you want to reach out to us, secondsons.org, you can send us a message through the website. And we'll get in touch with you and bring you in. And the idea here is like we're your friends. Like, you know, we have a saying, you know, find your friends, like come find us, because we need good men to get involved or we're screwed. It's very simple. Like if not enough good men get involved, nothing's going to change. So all I can say is, like I said, I don't want your vote. I want your soul. So I got to find a better way of wording that, but
I understand, but I think it's a noble sentiment. All right. Well, this has been great. So thank you for agreeing to appear on Millennial X.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really an honor to be part of the 10th Millennial, and I really enjoyed it the last couple of years, so it's fun to be on it. And, Merry Christmas and a Happy Yule to you, man.
All right. You too. Thank you very much. And I'll be back for the final one tonight in about 10 minutes, and that is with Isaac Young. But in the meantime, Ferry, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Cheers.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.